Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. Our guest today is Tony Early, and I've asked Mr. Early to talk about creative nonfiction with us today. And I met Mr. Early back in the mid-90s. I was lucky enough to hear him read from his first collection of stories at the time, which is Here We Are in Paradise. Then I was also fortunate enough to hear him read from Jim the Boy, his first novel. Today we're going to be discussing Somehow Form a Family, stories that are mostly true, and all three of these books are available in nice trade paperback editions. So first of all, Tony, thanks for joining us today.
That's my pleasure, Casey.
I can remember after Jim the Boy came out and I read it, enjoyed it very much, that I started seeing your creative nonfiction pieces appearing in the New Yorker, the Atlantic. And how did that process evolve for you as a writer?
Sort of out of necessity. For a while after I got married, after I was out of graduate school, I wanted to make a living as a writer, and one of the entrees open to me was writing creative nonfiction for magazines. And as I was doing that, I wrote the pieces, the individual pieces, with the idea that I could collect them someday. To be honest, I don't believe in writing anything I can only sell once.
Yeah. Did you think about writing a memoir, or did this make more sense to you to do it this way?
When you look at that book, it's memoirish, but mm-hmm. I never considered writing a memoir because, frankly, I've never found my life to be that interesting.
So that we can have the listeners understand what we're talking about when we talk about creative nonfiction, would you do me a favor and read the first couple pages of The Choir Gene?
Okay, but where I'm from in the mountains, we call it choir.
The choir. If you just read the first couple pages of that, I think it would give the listeners a good idea of what it is we're talking about. It's a wonderful piece.
Okay. I do not like, have never liked, nor expect to like watermelon. For the record, I consider this a private dietary preference, not a political choice, neither sign of failing character nor renunciation of Southern citizenship. I simply do not like watermelon. Nor, for that matter, grits, blackberries, cantaloupe, buttermilk, okra, baked sweet potatoes, rhubarb, or collard greens. Particularly collard greens. I don't even like to look at collard greens. But because I am a Southerner, a North Carolinian of Appalachian Scotch-Irish descent, offspring of farming families on both sides, my family finds my failure to like the foods they like somehow distressing. Whenever I eat at my grandmother Ledbetter's table, my relatives earnestly strive to convince me that I am making a mistake by not sampling this or that, that I do not know what I am saying when I say no, that I should just try the greens, have just a little slice of watermelon, a small bite of cantaloupe, that eventually I would get used to the seeds and blackberries, the mealiness of grits, the swampy odor of greens boiled too long in a big pot. And when I refuse, as I have been refusing with passion and steadfastness for as long as I could talk, they stare at me for a few seconds as if they do not know me, their mouths set sadly, then look down at their plates as if preparing to offer up a second grace. Then my grandmother says, "Tony Early, you're just choir."
And the rest of the piece goes on to talk about the Appalachian words that you use. And you teach writing now at Vanderbilt. And how have you assimilated that into your teaching, or is it just something that you've just gotten used to now and it doesn't affect you that much?
Well, I was a little nervous at first when I first started at Vanderbilt about the possibility that some of these words or colloquial phrases might creep into my language, and I policed myself pretty carefully. But it's become more for me a story of, I like the story that those words in my vocabulary tell, that they're almost like genetic markers of my family's past, and they signify where I came from. In day-to-day speech, they usually probably only come out if I'm talking to someone in my immediate family. You know, it's not part of my ordinary lexicon, but it's there, and I like, as I said, the story that those words tell and through those words, I can trace back, you know, where my family came from. Some of the words that my family uses that aren't in wide use, you know, are close to 1,000 years old.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when you sit down to write a creative nonfiction piece, and you're talking to your students about that, what's the different mindset that you go into versus whenever you're just making stories up whole cloth? Because your stories are very entertaining, and you say they're mostly true. And how do you differentiate the two when you sit down to write?
The difference isn't as great as I would have thought when I started this process. Most of the pieces in Somehow Form a Family resemble short stories more than they resemble formal essays. The piece you just had me read from, that's the only piece in the book that really looks, you know, and sounds like an essay. And the others, if I tweaked them slightly this way or that and changed a name or two, I could have said that they were fiction. You know, they're narrative pieces with an accompanying metaphorical construction. So they feel like stories to me. So when I wrote them, it felt like I was writing short stories, but I was writing a short story in which the main character was Tony Early, and the only difference was that they were ostensibly true.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back a little bit, and when you finished your book of stories, Here We Are in Paradise, I can remember when you finished that. Tell us a little bit about that period between the finishing the stories and writing Jim the Boy, which was your first novel, which was published to great acclaim, and I believe was made into a television movie. Is that correct?
It's been purchased by a production company, and where it is in production, I have no idea. Once I signed the check, they stopped calling me.
Okay.
Well, the period in between Here We Are in Paradise, which came out in 1994, and Jim the Boy, which came out in 2000, wasn't a real easy time. During that time, right after Here We Are in Paradise came out, I sort of got struck by lightning when Grantham Magazine named me one of the best novelists in America under the age of 40.
I remember that.
And I hadn't written a novel. Didn't know if I could write a novel. And while it was a great honor and certainly helped my career, every time I sat down to write a sentence, I would write a sentence and think, well, that's not one of the best sentences in America. And I just used this honor to manufacture a lot of pressure on myself. Mm-hmm. And as a result, it took me longer to write Jim the Boy than I think that it might have otherwise.
And so that was kind of a mixed blessing to get crowned by Granta, in hindsight, would you say?
You know, I wouldn't even say that it's a mixed blessing. I certainly wouldn't give it back. And I don't regret it, but it did make the writing process more difficult. Mm-hmm. It's much easier for a writer starting out, I think, because the worst thing that could possibly happen, which is complete anonymity and indifference to your work, has already happened. You know, a writer starting out has absolutely nothing,
right,
nothing to lose. And if a writer achieves some level of success, then there is at least the feeling that there's something to lose, the appearance mm-hmm. of something that can be lost. Whether that's accurate or not, mm-hmm. you know, may or may not be the case. But that's certainly how I felt.
Mm-hmm. And how did you? I know we're at the University of the South, Sewanee, and this place has been kind of a special place for you, hasn't it?
It certainly has. I've been coming here to the Writers' Conference in one capacity for another for about 10 years.
And is this place? And now you're living in Nashville, correct?
Correct.
So does this kind of feel like old home week when you're here now? Now you're on the faculty. You've gone from being staff to being on the faculty. Is this an important part of your life story? Would you say the University of the South and how it's kind of nurtured you along?
Absolutely, and great fondness in my heart for Sewanee, and in particular for the Writers' Conference. In my ordinary life, even at Vanderbilt, where I teach, you know, there are 30-something people in the English department, but only 5 writers. And this 2 weeks it's the only 2 weeks of the year where me and my kind are in the majority. Mm-hmm. And everyone you talk to is a writer or someone who wants to be a writer or someone who works with writers. And we have our own little world up here on top of the mountain for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. It always feels lonely leaving the writers' conference and going back into the real world where suddenly there aren't a lot of writers around mm-hmm. anymore.
What's the difference, would you say, the 2 weeks you spend here with the students that are aspiring writers versus the work that you do at Vanderbilt? Is it a more intense structure here, would you say, for the 2 weeks that you're here teaching?
Well, it's more intense because it's a shorter period, and I think that the students at the Writers Conference, they tend to be older, mm-hmm. and I think that they tend to feel that they have more at stake. They've gotten to a point where they really think that they need to do something with their writing. They need to figure out how to take that next step. And the undergraduates that I teach, most of them aren't really feeling that kind of pressure yet. Mm-hmm. You know, and I start from the first day of class, and I say, look, you know, you've got all the time in the world. There are no good 19-year-old writers simply because there aren't supposed to be. Mm-hmm. But you can't give that same speech to someone who's 50 and is taking 2 weeks out of their ordinary full life and at some expense to come up sure. here and try to figure out how to take the next step.
Sure. And how do you what advice is different than when you're working with the undergraduates versus the 50-year-olds that come here to Sewanee in terms of when they say, Tony, what would you recommend that I do to try to get my writing to the next step? Is it the same advice that you give to both, would you say?
The advice isn't that different. And what I often wind up talking about with prospective writers of either undergraduates or people at the Writers Conference is to not worry about publication. Mm-hmm. Because often the question I get asked when I'm approached by an aspiring writer is, what do I do to get published? And that's not the right question. My answer is, well, first, you know, learn how to write, learn the craft, because I honestly don't believe that there are any genius writers out there living in basements simply because the world doesn't understand them and is conspiring against them. You know, the entire publishing industry, from the smallest literary magazine to the biggest conglomerate publishing house, is actively looking for people to publish. You know, this whole world is constructed on the premise of finding people to publish. And I honestly believe that when a writer achieves a certain level of competency, their work will find a home.
And Gary Fiskejohn this morning told me that he doesn't think there are any really fine novels that aren't being published. He thinks that the novels, when they reach the point where they are publishable, they will find a home.
Oh, I absolutely believe that.
Yeah.
And occasionally I will run across someone who's just sort of resentful toward me personally, and the implication is that I'm a member of some secret cabal, and and that if I would only tell them the secret password, that they could be a member of the cabal too, and that they could get published. And you know, the idea that Tony Early from Rutherfordton, North Carolina, could be a member of some secret New York City cabal is just ridiculous notion. You know, I began to get published, and hopefully will continue to be published because I learned how to do what I'm doing.
And how important would you say reading is in the maturation of a writer? It seems that a lot of aspiring writers, some don't want to put the time and effort into really reading good literature and really learn the craft, almost that rush to publication mentality.
Well, the first step of learning any artistic process is imitation. I don't care what it is, and that's as much true in writing as it is, say, piano playing. And writers have to read, particularly starting out. And before you can figure out how to sound like yourself, you have to figure out how to sound like other people. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all using the same toolbox, and the secrets to how to use the tools in the toolbox are in the books that have already been been published. And the worst thing that could happen to a writer just starting out, or even a writer who's become fabulously successful, is that the only voice they hear is their own. You know, no good can ever come from that. So yeah, writers absolutely have to read. Writing's a funny art form in that it's the only one I can think of where one can say, I'm a writer, and then assume that they are. You know, no one would ever say, I'm a piano player, when they haven't taken a piano lesson or never sat down at a piano. But someone can, you know, turn on a computer and say, I'm a writer. It's like sitting down at a piano keyboard and hitting one note and saying, I'm a piano player. Mm-hmm. So it's a funny business that way.
It is funny business that way. Yeah. Well, Tony, I want to thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk with us today. And I wish you nothing but continued success. And we'll catch up with you down the road when the next book comes out.
Thanks, Casey. I hope so.
Thanks.